Hello, I'm Matt Matem, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie magazine. Today, I'm joined by our news editor, Laura Miles.
Hi.
And this week, we'll be hearing from the writer and director of The Bike Riders, Jeff Nichols. Plus, we'll be reviewing that film, as well as Green Border, The Exorcism, and Something in the Water. But first, Lauren, have you been watching anything else this week?
I've been catching up on some older stuff from earlier in the year, actually. I just finished watching Masters of the Air on Apple, which, funnily enough, also has Austin Butler in it, like The Bike Riders. But yeah, he's very good in that as well.
How did you find the show on the whole?
Yeah, I thought it was really good. I think you've got that real sense of camaraderie between, you know, these pilots in the war doing these extremely dangerous kind of bombing missions. And you really get the sense of the friendship and the bonds between them, even as they, you know, go through, you know, end up landing in enemy territory and going through all of these really terrible things. But yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Apple TV does seem to be a pretty safe bet for prestige TV shows, isn't it? Like they're generally pretty high caliber, aren't they? This week, I've watched a couple of things I'll probably end up mentioning during the episode that I felt were sort of relevant to a couple of the films that we're reviewing. So I caught up with Netflix's Under Paris, the French shark movie that's been, you know, making a bit of a splash on there. And I also caught up with The Pope's Exorcist, which I hadn't seen, but I wanted to familiarise myself with Russell Crowe's exorcism output ahead of The Exorcism. And also something exciting, which I did actually get to see this week, there was like a little kind of sneaky peek of Alien Romulus was put on in London for press, and Fede Alvarez, the director, was there. So we basically saw about 20 minutes of footage, and then there was like a talk by Fede afterwards. It was only really like a little kind of teaser taste of it, which to me was good, because I sometimes feel that you're sometimes shown advanced footage of these things and you feel that you've seen like too much of the film. And he specifically said it was kind of edited in such a way that they didn't want to spoil it for us, didn't want to give too much away. There was a couple of quite big edits there where you're suddenly like, oh, like we've moved on a bit, because they were obviously holding some stuff back. But what we did see, It just looked great to me, really, just as far as I'm concerned. I kind of don't really have a negative thing to say about it, just because I just loved the kind of texture of the world and being back in that world, and the timeline being, you know, set a bit after the original Alien, and just all these kind of battered ships, and just love that whole look in sci-fi. And it does look to be very kind of gnarly in terms of the scares and the gore and that kind of body horror coming back into it. So it left me very, very excited to see more of that. But that was a cool way to spend Monday morning this week.
Yeah, I'm really jealous of that. I really wish I could have been there. But he's clearly got that job off the back of Evil Dead, so I'm really looking forward to, you know, bringing it back to the horror roots of the franchise.
Yeah, he's very much leaning into that, and it's clear that he is just very passionate about the franchise as well. Just the way he was talking about it, and that it's this was the one thing that if he's asked, you know, if you could do anything, what would it be? It's an Alien movie. And yeah, so he clearly has that love of the franchise. And he's also just a very, I didn't really realize this about him, because obviously a lot of his films are on the intense side, but he was just a very funny guy as well. Like he just came up with some really funny stuff during the Q&A, and when he was talking about his first meetings with like Ridley Scott, for example, and just talking about various other things about it, and you know, his history and affection with the franchise. He was a very entertaining talker, as you find with certain people. But yeah, he was really, really a great talker. So yes, that was great, and left me very, very fired up for Alien Romulus in a couple of months. So that was a cool start to the week.
Game over, man. It's game over.
So let's get on to this week's new releases now. So grab your biker jacket and rev your engines for this one.
Kathy, why don't you talk to me about when you first met the guys?
From the beginning. It was a golden age for motorcycles.
Somebody told me you're the guy I need to talk to. You're the man in charge.
I built this club out of nothing.
I never felt so out of place in all my life.
That's when I saw him for the first time.
I'm Benny.
I have to admit, he took my breath away.
So this is The Bike Riders, the new film from writer-director Jeff Nichols, previously known for the likes of Mud and Midnight Special. And this is a 60s set drama about a motorcycle gang, largely told from the perspective of the wife of one of the gang's members. And it's actually based on a photo book by a guy called Danny Lyon, who immersed himself in motorcycle gangs and followed these people and photographed them and sort of documented their way of life, really. And before me and Lauren review the film, Here's an interview with Jeff Nichols from last year when he sat down with Total Film contributing editor and former host of this podcast, Jane Crowther, during the London Film Festival.
Burn it down.
We gotta go.
Nah, we don't. They're scared of us.
After that, things with the club really changed.
What this club is now.
You can't have it.
You can give everything you got to a thing. It's still just gonna do what it's gonna do.
Were you at all interested in bikes? What was it about it that so engaged you and has kept you engaged over all these years?
I wasn't really that interested in bikes, to be honest, or biker culture, especially current biker culture. Really doesn't interest me very much. Yeah. I was interested in these people. You know, the interviews and the book, they really show kind of a psychology behind working class people and working class people that gather together into this very unique group. I think that's what drew me to it. And honestly, Kathy was fascinated by her. She seemed very honest and she just kind of told it like it was. At times, you know, you're judging her for it because she's saying things. You're like, don't say that. Don't do that. What are you doing?
Yeah.
At other times, she's introspective and self-deprecating. And I loved that she represented kind of the same thing that I feel, which is this tension in masculinity. It's this kind of pull between the realities of it, which are very true and very real.
Yeah.
And very attractive, but also kind of the falseness of it and the silliness of it. She's representative of that because she's stuck in the middle.
Yeah.
And I just like the people. They do just look awesome.
Mm.
Between the hair and the patches and the dirt and the grease and the bikes themselves, it is just a very romantic subculture.
Yeah. And this plays a little bit like a Western. Don't mind me saying that.
No.
So these are sort of modern day horses, as you were. So was that intentional to sort of evoke the sort of Clint Eastwood guy in Benny that is the man with no name in a way? And he's sort of like this, the guy that all men want to be and all women want to be with, and is an anti-hero. And he's a real kind of idea of that masculinity that you're talking about.
What I found interesting about it, and this is the character dynamic that I built. It really wasn't in the book. First, to your point about the Westerns, that kind of just comes with the territory. You know, you put guys on iron horses and you're going to get some Western comparisons. The thing I found interesting about the Benny that I created was, you know, you start pulling on that thread a little bit. Okay, who's the guy in the bar that you want to go home with? Okay, that's Austin Butler. Who's the guy in the bar that you want to be put on the back of his bike and ride with? You know, like all that's pretty obvious. But once you start pulling on that thread, what's really there? And I kind of liked this idea that you build this love triangle, not between two men chasing after the same woman, but actually a man and a woman chasing after the same young man. But what if that young man is empty? What if ultimately that young man is not built to bear the weight of other people's ideas for him or their needs? I compare him kind of to like an empty glass. They keep pouring things in and there's nothing there to catch it. It just keeps running out. Well, that feels tragic. At first, you think it's kind of funny. And this thing is, oh, look, it's Kathy and she's with these guys. But by the end, when she comes into that bedroom after the red dress scene and confronts him, it's heartbreaking. And it's heartbreaking because she knows he's right. When he says, what did you think this was ever going to be? It's so obvious. And it's obvious to her as well. That's what makes it heartbreaking.
Well, if we take it from the Shangri-La song that plays as they go over the bridge, that might suggest that he's always left his heart on the street. He'll always hear those bikes roaring. And actually, are they really happy? And she says it in such a beautiful, opaque way that we don't really know. And I love that you can read into that either way.
How great is Jodie Comer?
Brilliant.
I don't think he misses it. And then this thing happens on her face where it's like, like you just have to be there and watch it.
The slight upturn of her lip.
Where you're like, she knows.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of the complexity of her character. We don't ever think she's a fool. She does things that we question at times.
Yeah.
Can't believe she put that dress on. But she's never a fool. But she's also trying to make something out of a situation that is challenging. It makes me care for her very much.
The book explores a lot of toxic elements of this.
Totally.
So, you know, like the squirrely girl, Big Bra, very, very sad story. And you've added that red dress element into there. But also Benny is a wife beater. You know, when they get together in the first place, she has her purse taken off her and she's forced onto that bike and she didn't get off. So tell me about the sort of balancing of that, of being true to the source material, but being aware that audiences in this day and age are not going to accept that sort of thing.
They wouldn't, have bought it, or they would have been repelled by it. And the first hour has to be romance. Like the first hour, we all have to fall in love with the culture. And it says a lot that we'll put up with violence, but there's some things we won't put up with. And the truth is, I had a moment in the original script where he actually, you know, physically did attack her, and you just immediately lose everything. There's no coming back from it. That couldn't be part of this particular story, the one I was trying to tell. To get to these bigger ideas of this feeling and this nostalgia and them together, because there would be no one wanting them together. It just changes the story entirely.
I know you talked about sort of casting these guys and that this trifecta of this love triangle, they have to be really appealing. And you have cast people who are really appealing, but you've managed to cast somebody who blew up as Elvis suddenly and has this huge female fan base. Tom Hardy is just a hugely talented, stellar performer who this role feels like he's been waiting for this to do this. And then Jodie Comer, who's, you know, one of our very best actors and astonishing, and has just won, you know, awards for her performances on stage. So tell me about the process of getting those people.
It started with Austin, not through any calculus. It's just how it happened. And yes, it was before Elvis came out. I had seen the trailer for Elvis, and there were just enough shots in that to say, that guy's done some serious work here. He actually reached out to us, I think, or his agent did. The script had been floating around, and it's a compelling part. We had some incoming calls, you know, people that were interested. And I knew I wanted to meet with this young man. And really, then I just met him. It was the experience of being with him in person that I, at this point in my career, I've been around a lot of famous people.
Yeah.
There is a real thing to being a movie star, and he has it. It felt like a pretty safe bet. And then came Jodie. She's recommended to me by my casting director, Francine Maisler. I hadn't seen Killing Eve, and I started to kind of devour it once I found it. What really struck me, though, it was just talking to her over Zoom the first time. The way she talked about Kathy was the way I felt about Kathy. She understood the complexity, and she loved her because I love her. Mm-hmm. And I felt like she would take care of her. So often you find people that look down on other people. And Jodie's not like that. I think Jodie really felt for her. I identified with that, and I felt like I had someone who could protect her. I still don't know everything I need to know about casting her. It's not till I was passing through town to visit with Tom for the first time that I saw Prima Facie on the West End. And it was at that moment that I was like, oh, I'm a genius.
Look at me.
I'm the luckiest guy in the world. It just felt like I had an ace up my sleeve.
Yeah.
The first week and a half, really the first 2 weeks, we were trying to film all of the outdoor scenes before the weather changed and got real nasty in Cincinnati. So it was a lot of the bike stuff.
Mm.
So Kathy's voice really didn't come till the end of the shoot. And it was like I had an ace up my sleeve the whole time. It's like, wait till Kathy gets here. Because she was even in some scenes, you know, but she doesn't talk a lot in some of those scenes. And it was like, wait till Kathy gets here. And then there was Tom. I'd been friends with Jack Wiggum, his manager, for a long time. Jack's brother, Shay, is a great actor that was in Take Shelter. And Jack represents Michael Shannon. So we're pretty close. It was no accident that I gave him the script pretty early on. And he called immediately and was like, Tom's got to do this. And I was lucky enough to get to go to his home and have a conversation with him about it. And immediately was just kind of floored by his intensity. He just had a million questions, rapid fire. Why? Mm-hmm. Why fists or knives? I understand, but knives. Why would he say knives? That's very dangerous. Anybody who's a real fighter knows that you don't bring knives up because a knife can get loose and you get stabbed. It has nothing to do with your strength. It's just very dangerous. So he's not a real fighter. Okay. So he's actually not a real gangster. So he's like, you can't be half a gangster. So that, and you know, I'm just watching in real time his mind process, and I'm like, yes, that sounds. Yes, that's good. And he said yes. But what an interesting dynamic, because they're completely different styles of acting. You know, Jodie, I think probably because of theater and probably going through television, like she's a worker. She's diligent, you know. And one day she left behind some of her work and she had phonetically broken down every single word that she said in the film. And you could just, you know, you just knew she had done her homework and put a massive amount of work into this. And Tom feels more like a natural event. you know, like this storm that kind of rolls through. And you'll watch him. He takes a lot of time in his takes. And sometimes it'll be way, way out here, way kind of off over here. And then he like drops in and it just nails it. And it's not a ton of takes.
Yeah.
It's like three takes tops. But there's this one moment and you can see it. You're like, there it is. And it's undeniable. And then he'll be back off kind of searching. It's a really fascinating thing to watch as a director. Whereas Jody's like, boom, 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 boom. Every take. I'll do 13 takes. And they're all a little different, but all right on point. It's kind of fascinating to watch the difference because both have these beautiful results, but you couldn't get more different in terms of their approach.
How does Austin figure into that?
He has more gears. I can't wait to work with him. You know, the truth is, Benny is a bit of an object in this film. He's the object of Kathy and the object of Johnny. And I was actually painting him as not just stoic, like actually to some degree emotionless, so that by the time we get to this end, there's this giant release. And I have to admit, it was a bit of a miscalculation. It looked good on paper, sounded good on paper. But when you have Austin Butler standing there, there's so much coming out. I almost had to sit on him on a couple of things, like, no, don't smile. Don't be so charming, because we want you to be kind of emotionally unavailable. But that was a mistake on my part, because what I saw, especially as I started to get into editing, was like, oh, no, there's so much there. You just kind of have to play with the actors that you have. And he had so much more to give than what I was allowing for, I think, on the page. Mm. And he loves making movies. He liked to talk about a quote that Tarantino shared with him. You know, they were in the middle of making Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Tarantino just turned and said, isn't this great? Isn't it great we get to make movies? And Austin kind of approaches life and approaches his work that way.
I want to talk about the love triangle and the fact that there's all this sort of homoeroticism in there, and that like there's no kissing or actual sex with Kathy. We don't see that, but we see of this gorgeous scene where Johnny tells Benny, it's yours, and he's not just talking about the club, I don't think. You can correct me, but it feels very much like the big romantic scene in this film.
I mean, I think it comes kind of with the territory. It really wasn't something we had to put the gas on too much. It just is there. Mm. And the truth is, that's the scene where Johnny reveals the depth of his affection. It seems to be kind of like a mirror scene to Kathy on the back of the bike at night.
Yeah.
That's her moment to fall in love. The trick with the Johnny scene is it's also when he gets his heart broken. That scene was good on the page, but it wasn't until Tom Hardy showed up that it became great. It was not written that way.
Right.
And I have to give credit to Tom
right.
for pushing it there. It was very sexual, and the hairs on the back of my neck stand up just thinking about the night that we filmed it. We started on a Monday. It was our first Thursday, so it was 4 days into the shoot. And we filmed this scene, and I just said, oh, well, this is something special. This goes beyond what was on the page. I actually resisted making Johnny a father figure to Benny because it wasn't that type of relationship. It really is a love affair, even if it is somewhat one-sided. I think Benny loves Johnny and would do a lot for Johnny, although Johnny asks the one thing that he can't do and doesn't want to do, which is take over this club. But yeah, there's an affection there. It has nothing to do with sex. It has everything to do with love. And Tom's the one that made that scene so beautiful. I have to give him full credit for that.
This was quite a quick shoot, and they were coming from different projects and from stage and what have you. So what did you do to make them feel like that gang?
Yeah, I mean, this kind of felt like an independent film on steroids, you know, because we had the biggest budget of my career, but at the same time, we only had 39 days going into the shoot, which was less than I had on Loving by 6 days.
Right.
There was the practical side of just getting these guys on bikes and getting them trained on bikes and getting them trained on these bikes because the period bikes are very difficult. They don't ride like normal bikes. They don't shift and like normal bikes. So that was just a pragmatic thing. And we had a 2-week course for them as soon as they got there. And they were all at different kind of riding levels. And so they all had kind of a different path in terms of learning these bikes. But then there's the other work. You know, Jody did her work on her own. She works with Victoria Hanlon, who's a dialect coach that she's worked with forever. And because I gave them probably about an hour of audio, they just went to town. But that was something that happened, you know, on their time, kind of in the background. So she showed up fully formed. Tom did his own work, you know. Austin, too, for that matter. Like, it was really interesting because there's kind of this constellation of of voices and actors. We had Victoria, we hired her. She didn't just work with Jodie, she worked with everybody. She was kind of available to everyone. And different actors used her more or less, depending on kind of their own preference. But I had audio examples of Zipko, for instance, from Michael Shannon, who grew up in Chicago, so he didn't need much. But even that, because he was like, yeah, I'm trying to get this Latvian thing in there, because he's got a little bit of Latvian in there. But then you have Boyd Holbrook, who's a phenomenal actor, who's playing Cal, who grew up in California but came from Canada, you know, and speaking French-Canadian. Everybody's got their own cross to bear, kind of, in terms of not just accent, but who their character is. And so much of that was brought out by Erin Bennick, our costume designer, because she, at once you could stand back and be like, yeah, sure, they look like bikers.
Yeah.
But each one has their own personality kind of built into the way they dress and the way they wear their hair and then how that develops over the course of the 60s into the early 70s. It was a tremendous amount of work, but everybody just kind of did their job. Mm. I certainly wasn't having to micromanage anything. Mm. You know, it helped, too, that we had such tremendous photographs. I kind of gave a packet to every actor of voices and of photographs to say, like, here you go. And that, with the script, I think kind of did the heavy lifting.
It's obviously this lovely period piece, but equally it has, I think, a lot of pertinence in today's society.
Sure.
What do you see it saying to audiences of today?
Ultimately about the search for identity. And I think that's something we're all doing. I would say the vast majority of people probably think they're outsiders. I think more than ever, we're looking for identity, because identity is really purpose. And because we're social creatures, a lot of us are drawn to groups to find that identity. And the more unique the group is, the more unique our identity is. And that can be a positive thing, but it can also be an extraordinarily dangerous thing. In a world that seems to be obsessed with identity, it seems like an appropriate time to look at that cycle and to say, okay, well, this is one way that it manifests. And, you know, what I was so fascinated by in the photographs, like we talked about earlier, it was the psychology behind these guys. And that directly feeds into the fact that you got Michael Shannon sitting by a campfire telling a story that starts out kind of funny and then turns out it's not funny at all because of really how this experience made him feel, which made him feel like an outsider and rejected by society. So yeah, I think it's an important thing to think about. Because I think it's a very human thing.
And you must be thrilled that from having that feeling about that book on the floor to actually having managed to pull it off in celluloid, you've actually done it. And, you know, you can sit here and say, I have actually made a film that's as cool as that book.
I'm really proud of it. There are these films out there that whenever they're on, you can just fall into them. And I wanted this to be that kind of film. I feel like if I catch this film on television in 20 years, if they still exist, you know, I could pick it up anywhere.
Yeah.
Because what that says is that we created a world, and that's what Danny's work did. And ultimately, that's what I wanted to do.
That was Jeff Nichols on The Bike Riders. So we heard a lot about the film from Jeff there, but just to sort of set it up in simple terms, it's a sort of sprawling ensemble story, obviously set in the 60s, and we're following this motorcycle gang called the Vandals, and they're led by Tom Hardy's Johnny. And in many ways, Kathy's kind of our window into the world, because throughout the film, she's giving these interviews to Mike Feist, who's effectively playing Danny Lyon, you know, the journalist kind of following them. So we're basically following their story really through her and her memories for the most part. Kathy ends up just randomly meeting Austin Butler's Benny at this motorcycle gang like hangout, basically, where she's there to meet a friend one evening. She, you know, is attracted to Benny, unsurprisingly really, given the way that like kind of Austin Butler plays him and the way he's presented and shot during this film. They immediately start this sort of passionate relationship, even though when they first meet, she's already living with another guy, but that doesn't really last too long as Benny just starts kind of hanging outside the house until the guy leaves, basically. And then they start this passionate affair, get married really quickly. But there's always obviously this pull between them and that domestic life and this family life of the bikers, really. And particularly there's this really strong connection between Benny and Johnny. And Johnny, who's like the leader of the gang, is eventually looking for someone to succeed him and take over. And he's got his eyes on Benny for that. And so there's this real kind of pull between the three of them of, you know, I suppose which way Benny's going to go. And that's the kind of main sort of narrative thrust of the story. It's a real kind of wide ranging ensemble and sort of, you know, story about that time, really, I suppose. But did you like this film, Lauren?
I did. I really liked it. I think especially you really see how the actors disappear into those characters. and especially with Tom Hardy, who plays Johnny, is you always kind of associate him with these big performances that, you know, you sort of go, that's Tom Hardy. But I feel like even though he is putting on another funny voice for this role, I feel like that really, really suited Johnny. And I feel like he really embodied that character without it being sort of too out of place or too sort of Tom Hardy-ish.
I know Tom Hardy can be sort of divisive for some people because of the big voices and everything, but he's someone I really do love his sort of screen presence. And I thought that was really well used here as the leader of this gang and this person that people follow, and just this kind of, yeah, sort of tough guy who's sort of leading them all. I really like this as well. And this was, we saw it fairly recently, but it's kind of been around for a while because it was one of those delayed films. The release kind of changed a bit. And so obviously, you know, I mean, it had that London Film Festival premiere, but then, and it was supposed to be coming out last year, but ended up due to the actors' strikes and things, was postponed. So only coming out now. So it's been kind of knocking around for a while. But yeah, I really, really did like it. And it's very much like, did you feel this in the sense that it's sort of a film about kind of mood and time and place more than necessarily like the sort of dramatic momentum? Did you feel the same as that?
Yeah. And I think what I liked about it as well is that you kind of, it's kind of about how times change over the course of the film. Because one of the interesting things about Johnny is he's very much a family man, and that biker gang is very much a family to him. It's not sort of a dangerous thing or a way to sort of escape from the confines of society and do bad things or anything like that. It's just a group of friends. Like there's these, it's quite funny actually, there's a moment where they explain that there are these rules where if you want to challenge him for the leadership, you can. And this guy challenges him and he's like, they're like, fists or knives? And he's like, fists, I don't want to kill you, man. You know, it's the opposite of perhaps what you would expect. And then it changes throughout the film to reflect the fact that perhaps the younger members are a bit less inclined to be that friendly group.
Yeah. They effectively have like picnics and sort of days out together, don't they? These kind of effectively family picnic days out. And yeah, and that's one of the things I really liked about it. Yeah, that you are just immersed in this world and this culture. I mean, it's had a lot of kind of Goodfellas comparisons, which I can understand. It is not exactly like a Goodfellas clone, I wouldn't say, but just in the sense of like someone coming into this world that's kind of exciting, but also dangerous. And there's also that kind of rise and fall element to it, as you kind of mentioned there with what happens, the way things go with the gang. But yeah, there was just something about being immersed in that time and that world. Just feels like the production design and everything like that and the costumes just really take you back. And there's also as well, I don't know if you found this as well, but it is one of those films where I just came out wanting a motorbike, basically. Like there's something about the noise of like the engines and just seeing people on these cool bikes with their leather jackets and their kind of cut off denim jacket waistcoat things over the top, that just thought, oh, I just want to go and ride a motorbike after this.
Notably, no helmets.
Well, like, I know
if we
that
crash, we die.
Yeah, that was slightly alarming to me. Yeah, but kind of don't really want to mess up Austin Butler's hair, really, do you, when it's like that? But then I also thought as well, like I thought Austin Butler was very good in this. I really thought Jodie Comer was great in it as well, because like, I mean, as this was discussed in the interview as well, but she has this accent for this character Kathy, which kind of obviously they looked at real clips and things like that, you know. And it was one of those things that when I saw kind of trailer clips, I almost felt a bit like, oh, does this feel a bit of an over the top voice when you're really sort of aware of someone doing a big accent? But then I found in the film I just got so sort of swept up in it that I just totally believed it. And I just thought it was quite an amazing performance from that perspective, really.
Yeah, definitely. It's the sort of voice where you would never expect it to come out of someone's mouth looking at her. You just wouldn't think that voice would come out of her. It's very much the character. Like it really rounds her out as a person. You kind of think of her as being a real person rather than Jodie Comer playing this character.
Yeah.
I like as well, there's a lot of really good supporting cast in this. They don't always show up as much as I think they ought to, but you've got people like Boyd Holbrook, who I always really like to see in things, and Norman Reedus, who play really sort of fun parts.
I mean, it just makes it feel, just very cool, doesn't it? Just with all those people tearing up, it just feels like a cool kind of cult in the making sort of film. And Michael Shannon as well. He's kind of got a small but interesting role, and obviously he's kind of got that connection to Jeff Nichols as well. In some ways, you almost feel like it could have been a bigger thing, or it could have been a series or something. You could almost imagine like a mini series where each episode focuses on one person. And even Mike Feist, who's kind of exploded a bit again this year with Challenges, he's not really even in it that much, I suppose, because he's just the conduit for getting these stories working. And you often just, he's kind of just there talking to them, or you kind of see him loitering in the background, snapping away. But he doesn't even have a particularly big role. But in some ways, I mean, there's a world in which you can imagine the whole film from his perspective, isn't there?
Yeah, I think it would lose something if it was, because you've already kind of got the element of it being sort of, it's framed in a way of this guy is observing, and so we're observing.
Yeah.
And there's, I think some of the side characters aren't as perhaps as developed as they could be. Like there's a character called Cockroach who goes on to have quite a small but significant role in the story development and has quite a big moment in the film. But actually the only thing you know about him up until that point is that he's nicknamed Cockroach because he eats bugs. Yeah.
It was interesting as well, because this happens, I find this happens a lot, like when you just watch a lot of films, but particularly I find this happens a lot of film festivals. When you watch loads of films, you see sort of weird connections between films that, you know, perhaps are there, perhaps aren't, perhaps you're just projecting them because you're watching so much. But I watched this very soon after I'd watched Sasquatch Sunset, which we reviewed last week, and I did find strange parallels, because it was felt like this sort of found family that are sort of living out of time almost, you know, and you kind of get the sense that their time is running out, they're perhaps not for this world. And it just was one of those weird things that I was like, wow, they're weird parallels between those two films that I was not expecting. And there's even just this sort of really tough alpha male leader, you know, and how that affects the team. It was, yeah, odd, but an interesting double bill if you get the chance to watch those two together. And I was going to say, yeah, so it's kind of stayed in my mind thinking about things like that and what it represents for that, you know, kind of end of an era sort of feeling, end of a American dream, maybe. It also, to me, without going into any sort of detail for spoilers or anything like that, but it had a really sort of interesting, ambiguous ending. Did you feel that as well? Because I was kind of speaking to someone else, we saw it with afterwards, and it was, yeah, it's just really, really kind of very, very open, and you could really interpret it in very different ways. But I found that interesting to mull on afterwards as well.
I think it is open, and I think it's quite optimistic in that sense of, you talk about it being the death of a dream or the American dream, perhaps. I feel like that ending kind of questions whether that dream ever really dies.
Mm. There's definitely that element to it as well. That was The Bike Riders, and if you fancy seeing that, that is in cinemas from Friday the 21st of June. And next up, it's another drama that is rooted in fact.
من بيلاروسيا على بولونيا ومن هنيك بوشنا لعند عمكم بالسويد.
رح يوصلكم على أحسن معبر حدودي، ولا تنسوا الشاب وصلته إجرته كلها.
شو هاد؟
So this is Green Border, the latest film from Agnieszka Holland. Lauren, do you want to set this one up for us?
Yeah, so this is Agnieszka Holland's latest film. She's a Polish director, and this film is very somber because it is about real life events that take place on the border between Belarus and Poland. It follows a group of refugees from the Middle East, and I believe it's set in 2021. They come over to Belarus because they are promised easy passage into the EU, an easy crossing over the border into Poland. And yet they find themselves, when they get to Poland, at the hands of the Polish border force, being treated in ways that are quite frankly very inhumane and very disturbing. It's based on a real political crisis, where basically the Belarusian dictator, Alexander Lukashenko, has been accused of engineering this and deliberately luring refugees over the borders into bordering European countries to cause political tensions. But it focuses very much not on the politics of it, but on the people that it affects. So we follow, for most of it, this family of refugees who are just trying to find somewhere safe to go. But also then there are other plot threads. There's a character who is a border guard, Jan, played by Tomasz Vlosok, who has a pregnant wife at home and is very much portrayed as a, you know, normal guy with a normal life who begins to sort of see how these people are treated and sort of think about his actions. And then there's another group of people who are activists who are trying to help the refugees, despite the fact that they are being demonized for it in their home country. And there's also another character called Yulia, who is a woman who kind of exists on the fringe of the story for a bit and has these political opinions. But she then decides to do something about it when she has an encounter with a refugee boy outside her home who needs help.
So another very much sort of ensemble story then, really, as well here.
Yeah, very much. And there's a lot of good performances there. And yeah, lots of different plot threads that really highlight all the different aspects of these issues.
Did you feel like, because I haven't seen this yet, so I'm sort of leaning on you for this, but did you feel like you needed any sort of background knowledge to come into this if you're not really familiar with the sort of political landscape as the backdrop? Is it easy to get into without that, or do you recommend a bit of pre-reading before you get there?
I think it's good to know the basic context, but I feel like because the film leans very much on human experiences and human emotion to kind of make you feel for these characters, I don't feel like it needs too much background info to kind of see these refugees who are suffering. And the film, some of the things that happen in the film are so harrowing and horrifying. It's not a nice watch. I feel like it's impossible to watch that and not feel for them and get a sense of the situation.
And is like Lukashenko, is he sort of featured in the film at all, or is he very much a kind of background?
Yeah, it's not really, I don't actually think he's mentioned by name at all. There's just this hint of there being sort of an engineered situation where these refugees are unfortunately caught in the middle between the two countries. You know, they're trying to cross over into Poland. And then you have the border guard. If they're not shooting people, they're chucking people back over the barbed wire fences back into Belarus. Like, I think one of the characters describes it as them playing football, but with real people. They just keep passing them back over the border to each other.
And is it kind of like shot in a sort of documentary sort of style? Has it got that kind of handheld docudrama element, or is it more kind of, you know, is there more classical sort of formal style to it?
Yeah, it's much more of a narrative film with, you know, these well-rounded characters, even though you know it's based on real events. I think it's really relying on the kind of empathy that you can create with characters and with narrative drama to try to sort of make you really understand this situation and really feel for these people. It's a very long film. It's about 2.5 hours, and it tries to cover a lot of ground in that time with these sort of four different plot threads that are going on. And it does feel like perhaps it's tackling too much and trying to sort of get every single angle of the scenario, and perhaps it doesn't need to kind of get that across.
As you've explained, it does sound like quite a tough and harrowing watch. Like, again, is it one, do you come away from it with any optimism, or do you just, is it come away with it kind of feeling righteously angry about the situation?
Yeah, it's pretty damning, to be honest, of the Polish government. There's the, except for that one character, Jan, the border force are portrayed as kind of just completely evil. Very early on, there's a scene where one of the higher-ups sort of says, oh, I don't want you to kill anyone, so if you see a corpse, make it go away. There is sort of no redeeming qualities to any of these characters except Jan, which maybe seems a bit shallow in that sense of there being one redeemable character in that group. But yeah, it's very, very damning of the Polish government. And I think, but actually, the Polish government are very angry with Agnieszka Holland for making the film. The Minister of Justice, when this came out over there, posted on social media and compared it to a Nazi propaganda film.
Okay.
So yeah, they are not happy with that representation at all. But it kind of, it really draws attention to what's happening as well. There's a little epilogue, which I think is really effective, where it jumps forward to the beginning of 2022, when Russia invaded Ukraine. And it kind of shows, by comparison, when the refugees are Ukrainian, they're not just welcome with open arms, but there's a whole organized effort to get as many people into safe countries as possible. So it's, you know, it's not just being welcomed, it's actively trying to move them from one place to another. And it sort of makes you ponder on, you know, what the differences there are and how few those differences are.
And so is it, and a final question for me, but is it very cinematic, would you say? Or is it one that, do you think it will kind of get anything from seeing it on the big screen? Or does it feel like something that's perhaps more comfortable sort of for watching at home?
I think it is quite cinematic, actually. I think there are some really big dramatic moments, really horrifying moments, but they are nonetheless very cinematic. And basically everyone in this cast gets a moment where they can go really big with it and make a real emotional impact. So yeah, I think actually this does probably benefit from a big screen. And also I think if you watch this at home, there are some moments where you'd be really tempted to just look away, look at your phone, yeah, get a snack, go to the loo, perhaps don't watch that bit. But I think, yeah, seeing it on the big screen and giving it your undivided attention probably really does raise the impact of it.
Cool. Well, if you fancy giving that your undivided attention, that is Green Border, and that is in cinemas from Friday. Now, we're swerving into horror fare for the rest of the podcast, starting with this.
So what's with this age?
Have you forgotten what kind of movie we're making?
Set, action.
Lord have mercy.
All kinds of messed up stuff happened when they were making movies like The Omen or The Exorcist. And the guy your dad replaced?
Everything's cursed.
So this is The Exorcism, which is the most recent sort of exorcism film starring Russell Crowe. This one is very different from The Pope's Exorcist, though, in case you saw it last year. But basically, we're in more meta territory here, really, where we're following the making of a film that is, I mean, it's not explicitly named as a remake of The Exorcist. So I don't know if we're supposed to think it is or not, but they're remaking what is apparently a classic exorcism film. So, I mean, The Exorcist is the obvious one that springs to mind there. And we open with an actor on set who's clearly impacted by the script and the work he's been doing on it. And we have this kind of dramatic opening where he ends up sort of falling to his death from this kind of set. And we're seeing it from the side, this kind of that doll's house view you get of those sets sometimes. So it starts there. And then we pick up the main story with Russell Crowe, who is an actor dealing with his own personal demons. So he's got a past marked by tragedy, and he's been dealing with alcohol issues as well. So he's kind of carrying this, and this seems to be something of a comeback film for him when he takes on this role, taking over from the actor who's died. And at the same time, in the mix is also his child, played by Ryan Simpkins. So there's that kind of father-child relationship as well to deal with, that's obviously not been the greatest over the years with everything that's happened. And yeah, then we basically follow him throughout the making of this film, as again he seems to be sort of troubled in a similar way to, you know, how the first actor was impacted by this, and we follow it from there. So it's this kind of meta take on the exorcism movie. I don't know about you, Lauren. I don't know what you thought about it, but I mean, obviously I kind of approached it thinking it looked somewhat like a throwaway horror film, and thinking it was somewhat strange that Russell Crowe was taking on just another exorcism film in such a short space. So, I mean, I know there's no rules about it, but it just felt a bit odd, especially as The Pope's Exorcist felt like it made a reasonable impact. Like, it felt like it got a moderate amount of attention. Felt strange from just to be going straight into another one.
I quite like it. It's kind of weird because actually The Exorcism was shot before The Pope's Exorcist. But it was shot back in 2019. So it's taken a while to get here. But it's quite funny in terms of the order of release that he's made The Pope's Exorcist, and then he's made a film that's basically like him going crazy on the set of The Pope's Exorcist, essentially.
And in honesty, I approached it without the highest expectations. And I sort of thought, again, compared to a lot of, you know, kind of low budget sort of horror films that you might just see kind of coming out without a huge amount of fanfare, I thought there were some interesting things going on. And like, I'm just always a bit of a sucker for films about filmmaking, films where we're kind of behind the scenes. So that always will just slightly pique my interest and slightly get me on side. I like Russell Crowe as well. And obviously he's one of those people that, again, he's just a kind of, you know, commanding presence. He just brings something to, you know, even to sort of lesser material. I think he does bring a kind of gravitas to it. And I thought early on, it was kind of interesting. And there was some interesting characters in the mix as well. Like, there's Chloe Bailey, who's the sister of Halle Bailey, and they've obviously been a musical duo together. But she plays the young actor in the film who's acting opposite Russell Crowe's Anthony Miller. And then you've got David Hyde Pierce, best known as Niles from Frasier. And he's the sort of on-set religious consultant, I suppose you might call him. So he's there to kind of consult, and obviously, you know, his experience and knowledge may come in useful in other ways as things start to go a bit off the rails. And then there's also quite a fun role I enjoyed as well, which is Adam Goldberg, another sort of person perhaps arguably best known for a supporting role in a sitcom from when he's in Friends. But he's the director, and I kind of liked him in a love to hate him kind of way, that he was just this quite detestable character in many ways and had some quite dubious ways of sort of treating Russell's character and getting this performance out of him. But I found it, you know, an entertaining character. And there's some sort of interesting little visuals as well. Like there's this, I think you glimpse it in the trailer, but there's this weird bit where you see this sort of animatronic head without the face on. That's kind of just quite an unsettling image, at least. So I thought that was a pretty cool image. And I thought there was a couple of genuine jump scares that did make me jump a bit early on, which again, you don't always get in these sort of films. But then to me, it then did basically just go a bit off the rails itself as it went on. As things progressed, I just felt like it just got a bit silly. And then by the end, I just didn't really feel satisfied where it had gone and how it ended up. But how did you find it?
Yeah, I definitely agree about it going off the rails. I think it's kind of ironic that in the film, they're making what is clearly an Exorcist ripoff. And then by that final act, they are doing an Exorcist. The whole film's doing an Exorcist ripoff. And it's just not that satisfying, especially compared to some of the other moments. Personally, I can't give away exactly what happens for spoilers, but I feel like the film peaked when Russell Crowe shouts something that I can't repeat here because it will get us an explicit rating, and then does something equally dramatic. And then, it's all downhill from there. But that moment is great.
Yes, similar to me, really. And I didn't feel like it was, you know, a total disaster, but just not great. And kind of, I suppose you can sort of see how it ended up on the shelf for a long time. It's hard to not imagine people rushing to see it. And it faces that problem that The Exorcist Believer had last year, that was the kind of legacy sequel to The Exorcist, where The Exorcist just towers over the genre, like, or the subgenre, should I say, just so powerfully that it's just very hard for another film to get a look in and to even compare and to not just have you thinking back to that film, which this one, like The Exorcist Believer, is inviting. And in some ways it's strange because there are a couple more interesting things with the meta elements going on in here than in The Pope's Exorcist. But The Pope's Exorcist, at least, it's just altogether sillier and more ludicrous and over the top. And Crowe's really just leaning into the fun side a bit there, slightly in the sort of Conjuring mold of that kind of slick, relatively effects heavy sort of horror film.
It's one of those scenarios when you've got a very sort of meta film and it's on the set of a movie. It's they have a moment where Adam Goldberg's character, the director, kind of basically describes what the film is, because he says the film within the film. He's like, oh, it's a psychological drama wrapped in the skin of a horror film. And then that's what The Exorcism is trying to do. But arguably, it doesn't need to be that, shouldn't be that. It should just be a bit of fun.
Yeah. And like I say, by the time it all resolves, like it kind of starts from an interesting place and this, you know, these demons of different kinds that he's kind of wrestling with. But it never ultimately takes that metaphor to a particularly exciting or interesting place, I wouldn't say.
But on the plus side, on the line of the supporting cast, you mentioned the actor who's in it for 2 minutes at the beginning is actually Adrian Pasdar, which I didn't know he was going to be in it, but I think he's fantastic. I'm a big fan of Heroes and Catherine Bigelow's Near Dark, and he doesn't appear in enough stuff. So I was really happy to see him, even if it was only for that moment.
And strangely as well, like Sam Worthington's in it as well, isn't he? He kind of pops up. It's sort of got an interesting cast. And I was also surprised to see that it's produced by Kevin Williamson as well, of kind of Scream fame largely. So it has this weird kind of caliber, but just doesn't really ultimately particularly deliver on it. But it's perhaps you can see why there's at least some interesting things in the mix and why people might have been sort of attracted to it. I thought David Hyde Pierce he looked very haunted in this film. I couldn't tell if it was just that it's been so many years since Frasier, or if he was, you know, under any sort of prosthetics and stuff, but he looked very haunted. Samantha Mathis is also someone who I think just isn't in enough stuff. And I'll always have a soft spot from my childhood fandom of Super Mario Brothers. again, I always have a sort of a flash of recognition when she appears in something. But yes, ultimately, I'd say it just isn't really the most satisfying film. And maybe you're better off sort of renting The Pope's Exorcist again if you're just in the mood for a fun Russell Crowe exorcism movie.
I was just busy looking up which Super Mario Brothers film you were on about. And you had a childhood fandom of the Bob Hoskins Super Mario Brothers.
I'm afraid to say so, yeah.
It's me, Mario!
It was just one of those, I saw it in the sort of, you know, the age before I developed anything like sort of taste or discernment. And I've watched it once like a few years ago. And it's one of those weird films I now appreciate just how truly bizarre it actually is, which I kind of obviously didn't as a kid at the time. I didn't realize just how off-piste they'd gone with this adaptation of the game, especially in comparison to when you think how slavishly accurate they went with the recent film. Yeah, it's just such a bizarre film. But it was one of those ones where I just had like all the toys from it and everything, you know, when you just get really into it. So yeah, weird. I'll always have a weird sort of soft spot for that film. But yeah, so ultimately it does have some interesting moments, but just to me, it wasn't that satisfying overall.
Yeah, I very much feel the same. It really goes off the rails. Mm. And even early on, the jump scares they're pretty cheap jump scares where nothing's actually really happened. They've just made you jump for the sake of it.
I am an easy sucker for a jump, though. So it sort of kind of worked me to that extent, but nothing to really sort of haunt your dreams afterwards. So, but if you do fancy giving that a whirl, that is The Exorcism, and that's in cinemas from Friday the 21st of June. And for the final film of the week now, it's another horror film to sink your teeth into.
Where are we going then?
This is supposed to be an adventure.
How do you even know about this place?
Who did you shag?
This is perfect. Ruth?
So this is Something in the Water. Lauren, do you want to set this one up for us?
Yeah, so this is, like you said, you were watching Under Paris earlier in the week, Matt. This is another shark film, very close to the release of that one. This one follows a group of friends from Manchester as they go away on a destination wedding to a nice sunny place. They expect cocktails and beaches and all these nice things. And what they end up with is being stuck in the sea with a nasty shark.
So that is the basic setup, and there isn't really that much more to it than that, is there? Because it's a short film. It's, you know, it's kind of clocks in, I'm pretty sure it's under 90 minutes. No, it doesn't. And this is one I must say as well, I just wasn't really a fan of this from the outset, and I went in with modest expectations again. But shark movies are one of those things, if it's a fun shark movie, again, a bit like that thing about how The Exorcist towers over the sort of exorcism subgenre, Jaws will just always tower over the shark movie inescapably. But if you can still have a lot of trashy fun with shark movies. And I wasn't actually the biggest fan of Under Paris. I know, again, it seems to have, you know, captured a lot of interest again, just because shark movies is sort of irresistible in a way. But I wasn't the biggest fan. But again, I thought at least it did have its moments. It had a few moments of tension, and it at least went really over the top in its approach and in its sort of take on the shark movie. It's just ridiculously over the top in terms of just the scale of it and what these sharks are up to, and kind of bringing it into the sort of the city element of bringing it into the River Seine. It did something a bit different and went a bit over the top. So I could kind of appreciate that at least about it, even if I wasn't, you know, again, wasn't really entirely satisfied with that. But yeah, this one, it sort of feels very low budget. So you don't get a great deal of shark action. It was just one of those films that I think when you're doing this kind of shark movie, you've either got to go for like make it super lean and super tense. Perhaps you don't have a huge budget for your kind of creatures or anything, but really just ramp up the tension, ramp up the characters, or just go super trashy, over the top, fun. The sort of film you kind of cheer along to with your popcorn. But this just didn't really kind of satisfy on any of those levels that I kind of wanted for a shark movie. And it sort of opens with this kind of homophobic attack. And it's obviously quite a shocking opening to this kind of film, which I wasn't really expecting. So it kind of establishes the main character as this survivor of this trauma, and two members of this party were kind of in a couple, and they've sort of split up following this homophobic attack and the sort of fallout from that, and how they kind of dealt with it. It sort of ended their relationship. And so this kind of wedding trip forces them back together. That there's sort of the Fantastic Five, this group kind of call themselves, or they say it with a kind of a sweary version of that, but I won't say it, because it'll just get bleeped out. But and then these other three friends engineer for them to, or not get back together, but, you know, sort of air their feelings. But just so much of it just didn't really ring true for me. Like so much of it. And like, I don't know how much it was the performances and how much it was down to the script, but a lot of the dialogue just kind of clunked for me, and just didn't really feel natural.
I feel quite bad for the actors in this, because it's really hard to tell whether they're actually good actors or not, because the material they've been given to work with is so shallow. And the film wants you to care about these characters and to care about the two that were together. It kind of wants you to care about, you know, whether or not they're gonna reconcile or not. But all of these characters are so shallow and vapid and have no personality. Even the main character, Meg, who is the victim of this attack, the only sort of depth that she has to her personality is that she has this trauma. And that's really the only thing that we know about them. So it's really hard to care about these characters when they're so wafer thin.
Yeah, and it almost felt a bit crass the way that was set up as well. And it also just sets the film on a very predictable path as well, really. I actually thought of all the kind of actors and performances in the film, I thought Hiftu Kwazem, who plays Meg, this main character, I thought she did bring something to it. She had some kind of gravitas to her, I thought, at least. But again, just nothing that could save the material, really. And it's one of those films where, this often is a complaint about horror films, but where people just behave in just highly unrealistic ways. The whole thing is, they're obviously at this kind of luxury resort, which I don't think it's ever made particularly clear where exactly they've gone, but this kind of Caribbean destination or something. And the day before the wedding, these five best friends, including the bride, go off on this boat trip to this secluded island. And they go on this really rickety old boat, which is, you know, the only thing that one of these friends can secure for them to get there. Even just right from there, you're kind of like, I mean, would this really sort of highly strung bride be doing that like the day before her wedding, when she's kind of got loads of plans that day anyway? I mean, and that's just the start of it, really, in terms of people behaving weirdly. And then you got like the three of them leaving the former couple alone for a while to sort the difference out. It just feels like friends wouldn't really do that to friends, especially ahead of a wedding. And that's just the start of it. And then on top of everything else, you just then don't really even get that much shark action in the film, do you? Like, you don't even really get that, which is the main thing you go for this kind of film.
Yeah, I think the nastiest thing that those characters encounter is the sunburn that they will end up getting, which is sort of, I kind of appreciate that as like, that's a little thing where they've paid a big attention to the small details with that. But that's really sort of the only thing that jumps out as being sort of something you appreciate when you're watching it.
Yeah. And there's, I mean, you kind of see this in the trailer as well, but relatively early on, there's a moment where someone gets a big chomp out of one of their legs. I mean, it is, at least it does feel quite gory and gruesome there. So they don't kind of hold back there. But ultimately, yeah, again, it was just didn't kind of deliver what I hoped for out of a shark movie, this one, to be honest.
The funny thing with that is that it happens very early on in the film, but that's really the nastiest thing that happens. Mm. Like, most horror films ramp up as it goes along, but that actually, it kind of gets that out the way early, and then nothing else really happens. Also, the amount of blood in the water when these things happen is too much. It's insane.
Yeah, like the whole bay is kind of turned red, isn't it? Even the sharks, just but they behave somewhat inconsistently as well, in terms of when they're there, when they're not, when they go off, when they don't. And just,
I
so
feel
much.
Like, it's very unclear whether it's one shark that's just a crazy shark, or whether all the sharks are like that.
But yeah, we don't see enough of the sharks really to fully know. But yeah, overall, I just thought it was just a bit naff, really. That's like, it's sort of, I always feel harsh calling a film naff, but just was a bit lame, really, overall. Not really satisfying on any level I hoped for a shark movie.
I don't know if it's just me, this picking up on sort of strange subtext, but they make this big deal in the beginning about how they're from Manchester and they're not that well off and they can't really afford to go on this destination wedding. And then when they're there and things start to go wrong, they keep making these comments like, we shouldn't be here. We're from Manchester. We don't belong here. It's like it's some kind of like fable for working class people that's saying, don't go on holiday abroad, paupers. The sharks will get you.
I must admit, I didn't pick that myself, but I sort of see where you're getting from. There is a bit of that element of the sort of class divide. It doesn't fully go down this route, but there's a bit of this, like, you know, almost are these people getting their comeuppance for throwing such an extravagant wedding and being so kind of spoilt and self-absorbed. But it doesn't really even go enough into that for it to be this kind of, you know, satirical spin on it, you know, or like Saltburn meets Jaws, whatever. It doesn't go sort of far enough to be like that even. So yeah, just, I must admit, I found it disappointing, because I mean, I'm always happy for a bit of a shark movie, and it felt like this could have almost been like I was hoping for a sort of sharky spin on Fall, that film about, you know, the friends stuck up in that tower, but I didn't get that, I'm afraid. But, you know, if after all that, if you still do fancy checking it out, that is Something in the Water, which is in cinemas from Friday the 21st of June. So, Lauren, what would you say your film of the week is this week?
That's absolutely got to be The Bike Riders. Mm. Just the caliber of the cast and the atmosphere and just how completely enjoyable it is.
I mean, as I mentioned, I haven't seen Green Border, which feels like the only film which could have really competed with The Bike Riders this week. But I will obviously be going with Bike Riders as well. I do highly recommend it. It's a film I really would recommend to a lot of people as well, because I feel like, again, I could see it being like a film that I could sort of recommend to my parents, really. But also because of it being kind of cool young cast, I could see it sort of, you know, appealing to younger audiences as well. So I think it's a good all rounder sort of film that I think people will sort of revisit it probably a lot in the years to come. Like, it doesn't feel like the sort of film that's instantly destined for like to be a massive blockbuster $1 billion smash kind of film. But I reckon it will kind of gain a lot of followers over the years, that film. So get in early and see it now. Get on board now with that. But we're approaching the end of the podcast now. Our Deadpool and Wolverine issue is out now as you listen to this. So you can find it in shops or pick it up digitally. So yeah, so there's lots of cool stuff in the issue. There's obviously, of course, there's the Deadpool and Wolverine cover feature, but there's also Kevin Costner and his cast talking about Horizon. There's Matt Damon on his new film. We've got Maxine, which is the latest in Ty West and Mia Goth's sort of X trilogy. There's a look back on Blair Witch Project as it turns 25. And I got to do the big interview with Natalie Portman, which was a sort of a real highlight for me. But how about you, Lauren? What kind of exciting stuff have you been doing for the new issue?
Yeah, well, my bit tends to do the look forward at all the exciting stuff that's coming out. So the big one is Eli Roth's Borderlands adaptation. That's looking like it's going to be very colourful and very interesting. We've also got a bit of exciting TV coverage in the issue. There's a look at the final season of Umbrella Academy over on Netflix, as well as the final season of Cobra Kai, the Karate Kid sequel show, in which we've been speaking to Ralph Macchio about that and about shooting the upcoming Karate Kid film. So there's lots of interesting stuff coming up.
And there's also Lord of the Rings, The Rings of Power season 2 in there as well. So lots of big TV heading your way. And if you subscribe to Total Film, you can now get instant digital access to the Deadpool and Wolverine issue before your first print copy arrives via our massive digital vault of back issues that you have access to as a subscriber. So if you do fancy signing up, there will be a subscription link in the podcast notes. And talking of subscribing, if you like this podcast, please do subscribe and review on your preferred podcast app. And remember, you can contact us anytime on our social media channels or email us via totalfilm@futurenet.com. But before we go, just time for a quick question. Lauren, what is your favourite movie motorcycle?
Oh, I think just because of the time period that I grew up in, I'm going to have to say Ghost Rider. because what motorcycle isn't cool if it's being ridden on by a guy with a flaming skull?
Exactly.
Who's played by Nicolas Cage.
I hope they bring Ghost Rider into the MCU at some point, because he is a character with so much potential for just being cool on screen, which arguably hasn't been sort of delivered upon so far in the films, at least.
They did a very good Ghost Rider in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which ran for quite a few seasons. But it's one of those things where I think unless you were getting into it as it was airing, it's probably something that hasn't been seen by that many people.
I was aware of that, but it did definitely passing by. So I watched like the first season of Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. and then it just fell by the wayside for me. But again, for me, with motorcycles, it's sort of, I mean, I'd have to pick my number one favourite, the Batpod from Dark Knight. I just love everything Batman and everything Dark Knight trilogy. And I just remember the first time I saw that scene where the tumbler is all sort of smashed up and then didn't even know what was going on. But, you know, you just have the wheels start whirring and then it kind of bursts out. It was just such an amazing scene, and just love what's done with it. But then in terms of a film from my childhood as well, that just always stick in my mind when I think of motorcycles being cool is Terminator 2 Judgment Day. And you get the double whammy because you obviously get like Arnie on his bike that he steals with and the biker leathers. So I just love that. And that whole stunt, you know, where it does the leap. Again, this was just sort of a pivotal moment for my childhood. But also at the age when I saw Terminator 2, where I was kind of arguably a bit too young to be watching it, but John Connor just seemed like the kind of coolest kid imaginable. And he has this little motorbike as well. So for that, I was just like, oh my God, like this kid actually has his own motorbike. So it just seemed like the absolute height of cool. So that is the one that always really pops to mind. And I think if we perhaps the Batpod counts as more of a, you know, superhero vehicle than a classic motorcycle. So on that level, I will give it to T2, because I just love both those bikes, and they're just so kind of tied up with childhood memories for me as well.
I hadn't actually thought of any of the Batman motorcycles, but I guess in terms of gadgets, like Bruce Wayne's got the cash to create the coolest stuff, so yeah, probably any best gadget, Batman has to be up there.
And he has kind of just a classic sort of motorcycle in The Batman, doesn't he, as well, that he sort of rides off on. Less flashy there, but I mean, who doesn't look cool on a bike? But one of those things that I feel like for me is probably best left on the cinema screen. Like I actually feel like I'd be probably, one, very scared of riding a motorbike in real life, and two, just, I mean, I just too nervous about accidents and things like that. And you either look cooler if you're sort of in the bike riders and you haven't got a helmet on, or if you're Batman and you've got like a cape billowing behind you as you're riding it. But as I sort of wouldn't have either of those approaches, best to just enjoy it on the big screen, I think. But that's all from us this week, so thanks very much for listening, and until next time, goodbye.
Bye. Get your motor running. Head out on the highway. Looking for adventure. In what lightning, heavy metal thunder, racing with